Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us tonight, live with Karen Shull. I'm your host, Melinda Garish, from Shirley, Indiana, which is just east of Indianapolis. We appreciate everybody joining us tonight, and we'll go ahead and get started. We've got several questions tonight that are selected. We're going to be talking about mohair cinches and kangaroo gloves. We're also going to be talking about the flight instinct, introducing a new horse to the herd, saddle fitting, and am I too big for my horse? So, Karen, we'll go ahead and get started here. The first couple of them with some questions and comments that were sent in by email that we thought would be good to discuss this evening. And one of them is the kangaroo gloves, which many of us have and love. And she just wanted you to know that and give you some feedback there that she loves the kangaroo gloves. She said they're bloody amazing. And thank you very much. Best gloves she's ever owned. And that one was from Laura. And do you want to talk anything about the kangaroo gloves right now and maybe why you select those and the benefit of wearing the gloves?
Yeah, well, Laura's comment indicates she's probably British or Australian because people use that terminology. Something's bloody anything, you know.
We don't do that in Indiana.
No. Right. People kind of go, really, that's good. And it is really good. But the kangaroo gloves, I mean, when people look at my website, they see, you know, really relatively few products. The reason I do that is because, to be honest, there's very few things in the industry that I feel that I can, you know, personally endorse by what I use and I experience the personal benefits from. And so when people see my website, I mean, you don't see big endorsements. You don't see, you know, me wearing people's logos, you know, and these kind of things. Because if it's not something that I'm going to use personally, it isn't something that I can wholeheartedly, you know, promote to somebody else. And it doesn't really matter what the, you know, I'm probably shooting myself in the foot because there's probably some good endorsement money that I'm letting go. But, you know, that's just how it is. So, you know, even the glove company, when they said, you know, Karen, we sell less expensive gloves that are deer and elk and, you know, these other hides. And I said, well, I understand that. But then I went on to explain to the glove company that the kangaroo hide is a very, very tough hide. It's a very thin hide, but it's very tough because the grain of the hide goes in all directions. It doesn't just go, you know, linear, you know, forward and back. It actually spreads out in all directions, and so it makes it a very fine hide, almost a paper-thin hide, but it's very, very tough. And when I use gloves, I actually, you know, years ago would really discourage people from using gloves because you reduce the amount of feel that you had in your rope. And when you're handling, you know, a 1,200-pound animal, you know, anything that's a very slight indicator that something's happening or they're giving or they're stopping, all those things, you don't want to miss it. And when you wear gloves, you can miss those things. So it's just like a race car driver. They have their favorite gloves. It's a golfer has their favorite gloves, you know, gardeners. You know, if you're doing anything to any extent, you start developing your personal preferences. And that's why, you know, this person, Laura, you know, and anybody that gets these kangaroo hide gloves, they put them on and they just feel like a second skin. Everybody is having the same reaction that I did when I put them on. Now, I wore them for about a year before I decided to make them available because I wanted to make sure that they really did hold up because I'm really hard on my gloves. So I don't just, you know, use them a couple times a week. I use them for my chores, everything. So I want to make sure that they really held up because somebody saying that kangaroo hide is tough and believing it, you know, are two different things. So everything that's on my website from gloves, everything, are things that I use because it enhances my skill and ability with my horses without diminishing the feel, and it really does truly hold up. Now, the benefit I found recently, and I think I was at your place there, Melinda, when I was trying out a new hide from the same glove company because they have a really nice fit for my hands. And everybody's hands are different, but they have a really nice fit for most people's hands. and that is a goat hide glove. And I've been using that glove for about a year. In fact, it, I think it was the second or third day at your clinic there, Melinda, when I came out with a kangaroo hide glove on one hand and a goat hide on the other, so I could feel it while I was interacting with the horses. And it was funny, a couple different times people stopped me and said, "Karen, your gloves are mismatched." I acted surprised, said, "Oh my gosh, I hate when that happens." You know, they didn't realize that that's, you know, part of what I do when I'm, you know, testing these different materials. So goat hide is actually another hide that we're adding to the website. And, you know, even when it changes colors, I just met with the glove company up at the Denver market in January, and they had the same goat hide but had a golden color to it. And they said, "We have some of this golden goats." I mean, it sounds magical or something, the golden goats. But I've just got a set of them in to use them to make, and they feel different. Even changing the color on a hide, it affects the tanning process and changes the feel. So, you know, there's another version of the goat hide that I'm testing out, but so far it makes it even more supple than just the regular goat. So, and the last thing I wanted to mention is, you know, more recently what I've found is in wearing gloves, I'm finding that it's saving my hands because it gives me a little more grip without making it too sticky. I can still let the rope slide when I'm getting the horse released, but I don't have to use so much strength in my hand to hold. You know, if a horse is really pulling on me, and, you know, if anybody's been to my clinics, you see, you know, horses that have a different idea of what they'd like to do. I don't pull, but I do my best to hold, and I don't have that much strength in my hands. My hands are starting to fatigue. And by using that glove, it helps me have a little bit of hold, and I don't have to use so much strength. My hands are actually less tired at the end of the day. But it's important when you wear a glove that you don't use anything rubbery or grippy or nubby, because when a horse does the right thing, you need to be able to open your hand and have that rope slide, you know, across the palm of your hand without too much drag on it. Otherwise, the horse tips their nose back. So it's a lot of different factors. And people think, oh, gloves are gloves, you know, but they're really not when you're trying to hold a conversation with the horse, especially when the horse is confused. So that's why when people put them on and they have this response, they go, "Oh, my gosh, they're bloody amazing." And they really are, because those are all the things that you're feeling, whether you're aware of it or not. So keep an eye out for the golden goat gloves, because they're working out really, really well. They're as supple as the kangaroo. They're less expensive, and we should have them on the website here in the next couple of weeks or so.
Okay. Well, great. I know, Karen, I've been shopping with you, and I know you really put things to the test. You ask a lot of questions. You do a lot of homework, and we appreciate mm-hmm. you taking the time and figuring those things out for us and giving us the opportunity to find out what works best. Out there. So there was another email that came in that was asking about the mohair cinches that you do, and she's asking about the Five Star Equine has the best mohair cinches, and she was wanting to know, you know, about, well, here, I'll just read this to you. It says, "Please, where do you get your mohair cinches with the brass fittings?" And this is from Sally right. Clark, and then says, "P.S. love your videos as well." And you did get an opportunity to respond to that. Would you like to do that, or you want me to read where people can find that information?
Well, yeah, actually, Five Star Equine is a company that I've used for years. And, you know, like I said, I go to the Denver market. I try to go every year. Sometimes I'm not able to, but I was there again this year. And I try to look for products that I like better than the ones that are my favorites now. And really, Five Star, the mohair cinches that Five Star is making are really ideal. Probably the important thing to understand with cinches is, again, you know, and this is the thing in the horse industry is, you know, when you're a kid, you use mohair cinches and, you know, wool pads, and then everybody comes out with high-tech this and, you know, synthetic this and polyfoam this, and, you know, you try all those things, and I am myself included, because I'm always looking for something, you know, that's better. So I've taken this big, long route, and guess what we tend to do is we come back and go, you know what, I like that old mower sense that wasn't so high-tech, but it breathes. You want a material in a cinch or a saddle pad that breathes, because that's against the horse's body. So it's just like us. You know, you remember when polyester, if you're as old as I am, you remember when polyester was the answer to everything until you wore it. And you kind of went, ooh, you know, a good old cotton shirt, you know, maybe we are it, maybe we don't. Who cares? It's comfortable. So with a mohair cinch, I prefer it more than cotton. I don't like a cotton cinch. I don't believe that it really has the strength. Maybe there's one out there that does, but I haven't found one to be as strong as mohair. And the other thing I like about Five Star, there's some other companies that make them, but I find that Five Star is probably the most reasonable when you get into, you know, a real high quality cinch. On the cinch, on the metal part, you know, in the cinch ring, I like that ring to be flat so that that surface area gets against the horse's skin. There's a wider surface area against the horse's skin rather than just a round, you know, ring that's on there, you know, especially in the springtime, this time of year when the horses are a little roly-poly, their voluptuousness can kind of get squoze, you know, into that ring. So when you have a flat piece against the horse's side, to me it feels a little bit more comfortable. I don't really like guards. Anytime people put something in between the cinch ring and the horse's body, that becomes a point of pressure. That area right there, if the cinch is fitted properly, should be in the gap. The cinch ring should lay in the gap right behind the horse's elbow. So it's a little pocket kind of right there. But like I said, on some horses, whether it's their breed type or individual or time of year, sometimes that area is pretty filled in. There aren't many gaps. And so I do like to have a flat cinch ring. And then the piece where the tongue of the cinch ring is, that piece, if you imagine a bar going across where the tongue is or the tab that fits into your latigo, that piece should be on the outside of that flat plate so that that piece is not touching, coming into contact with the horse's body. So if you look at, go on 5starequine.com or just look at 5star equine and you'll find it, and you look at the cinch rings, and you can actually select from different types of rings. But those are the ones that are my preference. Everything that I've got from 5star, from pads, cinches, everything, have been very high quality, and they're probably going to be a product that I'll start to carry. I don't right now, but I do not mind at all to direct people, you know, send people their direction, because their customer service, the people, the owners, everything, they're just fantastic people. And I really enjoy doing business with them, and I would recommend them to anybody. So.
Karen, what was it on the smart cinch that you didn't like? I haven't looked free from mine yet, but it seemed like there was something that you didn't like about it.
You know,
that.
This is my preference, because when they came out, I thought, oh, this is a great idea. It has rollers on it. So people that don't have a lot of strength, and there's two rollers, so it actually uses leverage. And what I like to say, because there's a big question, people say, well, how tight should the cinch be? You know, it's always a question. We think, oh, it's too tight. And, you know, I'll give you kind of a general perspective here. I don't know anybody that's got in trouble with a horse because the cinch was too tight. I've only heard of people getting in trouble with a horse, myself included, when the cinch is too loose. So that's why I cinch a horse over 3 cinching. I don't just cinch a horse once and get on. I'll do it over 3 cinchings. I'll do some things on the ground, untrack them, send them around me, do some things to get the horse breathing, then I'll cinch them up gradually again. That's another thing is people think, well, I got to, you know, fold them inside out, you know, suck that cinch up on the first cinching. That's not comfortable to the horse. So I found a way to get my cinch nice and snug that's not obtrusive or offensive or uncomfortable to my horse is by doing it over 3 cinches. And that seems to work out really well, you know, on the horse's side of things. And then what I want to think about is that to get it tight enough over 3 cinchings, you'll be amazed how much you'll get in the second cinching and how much you'll get even in a third cinching. Before you ever put your leg over, you know, over the back of the horse, you know, make sure that that is as tight as you can physically get it. Most women, not all, but most women would have a hard time over tightening the cinch on a saddle. It'd be hard to do. Okay. In all my years of teaching and all the, I don't know, it's got to be thousands of people that I've had come into clinics. One time did I have a person come in, and it was a big, strong guy, and he had a younger horse, and he just had that horse cinched up too tight. And you could see it in the horse. He was kind of walking kind of, you know, peg-legged in the front. And I kind of went, hey, you know, this might be a little bit too tight. But that's one time out of thousands. So it'd be really hard to cinch it too tight. I'm more concerned about having it cinched, too loose. That's when people get into trouble.
So you don't like the roller in the smart cinch then?
Well,
I tried to follow that.
Roller, well, what the roller does is it puts leverage on it. So you can over-tighten. The average woman that I'm saying would have a hard time over-tightening a cinch. With a roller cinch on two pieces, it acts as leverage. I could physically, right now, you know, physically, it'd be hard for me to over-tighten a cinch, okay? Mm-hmm. But if I had a roller cinch like that and used leverage and it rolled, I could. I could over-tighten it, and I wouldn't know, because anytime you use leverage, what leverage is it changes the ratio of pressure, which means I'm feeling 3 pounds of pressure, but what's actually on there is 10 pounds of pressure, depending on how the leverage is set up. And I'm not saying that that's the leverage ratio on roller cinches. Now, that may help somebody that, you know, say it's a young child or somebody that has, had hand surgery or, some sort of disability in some way. It may be something that's helpful if they have the awareness, you know, what it is that they're doing. The easiest way to know if your cinch is tightened enough or not is when you get on, even if you're getting on from a mounting block, put full weight on one side of that saddle. And I hear people all the time going, oh, no, I don't want to put any torque on my horse's back. Well, you know, we're not that heavy relative to the body mass inside of the horse. I imagine if somebody got on and off a horse, you know, 30 times a day or something like that, whatever, you know, it could. But the average person is not going to put enough torque on a horse's back. But it's very traditional, especially in English areas. I brought this up in a presentation I did the other day, and a woman raised her hand, and she said, oh, yes, I've been told never to get on a horse without a mounting block. Don't put any weight on one side of the saddle. And I said, is that from your English? And she said, oh, yeah, I grew up on the East Coast. She said, that's what everybody's told. To me, if you get onto a saddle and you have not put full weight on one side to see if that saddle is going to flip, you're putting yourself at risk. And I've never seen a horse get a sore back from people mounting and dismounting. You know, I just haven't seen it. But I've seen plenty of people get in trouble because they take a jump or a cavaletti or the horse moves unexpectedly in some way and that saddle slips and rolls. And, you know, maybe they're not all the way off, but they could have been off if the unexpected movement would have been any bigger. So anything that puts human beings at risk, I just have to question it. I really have to question it. So that's my recommendation. Even if you use a mounting block, if you're getting on from the ground, obviously you're going to put full weight, in one stirrup, unless you're, you know, the young guy. And I used to be able to do this. I used to be able to jump up and put my left foot in the stirrup and pop on in, and I never even put weight, on that one stirrup as I was getting on. So it's just something to think about, you know, when you're around horses. It's these little things that will prevent these, you know, bigger things from happening, hopefully.
Okay. All right. Well, great. Thanks for answering that. We'll go ahead and we'll move on to question two here. And this one is from Paige. It says, hi, Karen. I've had a really nice trail horse, about 13 years old. Has seen it all, been there, done that. However, he lives in a community barn with 80 other horses. We all have our own unit. We have arenas, round pens, etc. When there is activity in an arena or a round pen, and I have to pass by, he becomes very anxious. Recently, I was doing some groundwork in the arena with him. It was a calm, warm day, no wind or other disturbances, and a woman from our barn area came galloping down the arrow that runs parallel to our barn area as I was walking my horse out of the arena. He heard the 7th Cavalry coming down the ravine and couldn't see anything. Needless to say, he exploded at the end of my lead rope. I had to duck, dodge for my life, all while holding onto the lead rope so he would not break loose and head for the highway. Is there any way that I can cure him of this flight situation? I'm very uncomfortable passing by other arenas out on the trail when people around are loping around and etc. I feel him tensing up, puffing. Who knows what's going to happen next? I'll wait for your advice. Ironically, he came from a guest ranch where he lived right next to an arena where mountain shooting took place all the time, as well as other activities. I would think he would be used to all things. Thank you, Paige.
Okay. Excuse me. This, you know, it's interesting. This is a very common scenario, and I've known people that they get into a pattern with their horse where, you know, if they're alone in the arena or alone, they're fine, but, you know, somebody else can come by and everything just falls apart to where they wouldn't even dream of, you know, taking their horse by other horses on purpose, things like that. The thing that's lacking, and this is a conceptual kind of an answer for you, Paige, the thing that's lacking is the leadership role between you and your horse. Because if you had the leadership role with your horse would be riveted on you, okay? And so here's my question, and I always like to go back to this. If your horse were with the lead horse, the horse that they just are in love with, fawn over, you know, that horse that bites them all the time and they're in love with, that horse. Your horse, if it heard other horses come along, that horse, if the lead horse remained calm and said, hey, I don't care what you do, but don't get on top of me, your horse wouldn't act like that with that lead horse. And if your horse ran into the lead horse, you know, that's why I ask people, is that, oh, the horse gets scared and he runs into me. And I go, well, if they perceive you in the leadership position, if they were standing there next to the lead horse, they wouldn't run into the lead horse. Well, actually, the answer is I ask people, you know, would they run into the lead horse? And you can see people thinking that my answer is only once. And then that lead horse would go, man, you better go anywhere but on top of me. That's the number one thing to remain safe. Now, I don't know this, but, you know, when I'm getting questions, you know, when people ask questions, particularly on the teleseminars, I'm envisioning this scenario. You know, so I see you coming out the area that you were doing some ground skills in, and you're coming through, and then, you know, you hear the galloping hooves, you couldn't see it, and then, you know, here comes this person, you know, galloping by. You know, look for options. I mean, always have your exit strategy. So, you know, in that kind of a scenario, if the gate was still open and you heard hooves coming by, just go, hey, I don't know what's coming, something's coming, and we're just going to go right back in the gate, you know, or we're going to turn a corner or, you know, something. You know, you have options. So sometimes we get it in our mind of what we're doing, the conditions start to change, and we don't always have the awareness to make a shift in our direction. I was leading a stallion one time, and conditions changed. And I'll tell you what, that stallion, I knew where I wanted to go with him, but the behavior started changing that I sent him. There were open pens, the gates were open, and I just had him go in those pens. And I just shut the door, and I said, we're gonna wait here until the conditions were beyond his capabilities at that moment, okay? So don't ever feel like, oh, you know, he should straighten up, or he shouldn't do that, or she shouldn't do that, you know, those kind of things. These are prey animals. These are living, breathing, thinking, feeling creatures. And when you get in those situations, any horse can, you know, lose perspective of who's in the leadership position. So a couple things that will help you. When I'm interacting with a horse and things are happening in the distance, say there's movement or motion or, you know, things are going on, you know, people will, oftentimes what will happen is when there's a commotion, the horse looks at it, and what we tend to do is we tend to stop, and then we might even soothe them. Okay, so I'm picturing the horse kind of, they'll pick their head up, their eyes will be wide, their ears are forward, their nostrils might be flaring, they're sensing for, you know, what's coming, and their head's up. And I've done it myself where, you know, when I didn't really understand, and we'll tend to come in close and we'll put our hand on their neck as if our hand is going to relax them. Well, when a horse is perceiving unknown danger, there's no petting. You can pet the fur off them until they're bald, and that is not necessarily going to calm them down if they don't perceive leadership from you. That's not what a lead horse would do. A lead horse wouldn't go over and go, oh, now, sweetie pie, it's okay. You just relax. Mommy's here. I mean, that's just not how it works with horses. That's what we tend to do as human beings, because we're a predator species. It's a different dynamic. So when the commotion's going on, what I tend to do is have the horse, I start changing things up and saying, what horse running towards us? I don't see any horse running towards us. All I see is that you need to have your feet over there now, and I'm going to help you get over there. And not in a minute, I need you over there right now. Okay? And if you do that when things aren't becoming disruptive, if that's your expectation when everything's, you know, rainbows and butterflies, then it'll be more automatic for you when, not if, when those things, you know, start to unravel. So, for example, the other day, my horses had been out in pasture, and I brought my one mare in, and she'd been hanging out with her buds, had her tied up. I went around the other side of the trail with the horse, and she hadn't been without looking at a horse for months. And she just kind of had a fit over there on the other side of that trailer. I mean, jumping up, all 4 feet were off the ground. I'm looking at her going, you know, she's pretty safe. I mean, it doesn't look like she could hurt herself or anything. But I stepped over there and I said, well, gosh, you want to move your feet. So I untied her, but I didn't untie her and soothe her and put her back with the horses. I had her back up. I had her move over. I had her go sideways. I had her back up fast. I had her come forward, turn, do this. And all of a sudden she kind of looked at me and said, whew, thanks, I needed that. See? And I tied her up again, and not to punish her, but just to let her know that, you know, I'm in the leadership position. I'll let her know what she needs to do. And she kind of went, you know what, we're cool. Everything's good. It wasn't punishment. I wasn't mean or mad. I didn't get after. I just said, you know, hey, you have a job to do. And sometimes that's the hardest job for a horse to do, is to be tied or stand still when a horse is galloping by. Those are challenging things, you know, for a horse. So I don't fault the horse. The question is then how do you assert yourself in that situation? And the best answer I can give you is to learn to assert yourself when those things aren't going on. I mean, if I could say in two words what my whole program is about, you know, I talk about leadership, building confidence and trust. It's really assertiveness training, because we're not taught how to do that. It's not something that, you know, is really kind of in our day-to-day activities, especially as women and young girls. We're taught to be nice or they won't like you. So when a horse gets scared, our tendency, our nurturing kicks in. We tend to want to soothe them. So think about it this way. If the horse gets upset and we back off and soothe them, we can actually create a pattern of behavior. And I actually have a name for it. It's so common. I call it the looky-loos. I've seen horses where they'll look off in the distance, whether there's something coming or not, and they'll put their head up and they'll look, and nothing. And the person will go, oh, gosh, and I'll notice the horse does it a lot. And I'll say, why is it? Oh, I don't know. She just does that a lot. And I'll go, oh, that's interesting. I said, now, if the lead horse were bearing down on her, would she just put her head up and freeze and look off in the distance? But if we remember that the release of the pressure is what reinforces the behavior that they're demonstrating at the time, we can understand how a horse can actually develop a pattern of, you know, what I've so fondly named the looky-loos, because we'll be asking the horse to do something, and they'll look off in the distance, and then we'll back off, and we'll look out there and go, what are you looking at, darling? The horse goes, nothing. And they don't even always understand why they're doing it. It's not a premeditated kind of a thing. It just becomes a pattern of behavior. Okay? So my suggestion for this, sorry, I get a little background noise. Somebody sounds like somebody's husband's talking with him. Did we mute everybody? Will I be able to get back on?
Do you want to go ahead and try to do that again, Karen?
Yeah, we'll do it here in a minute. So here's my suggestion. I want to give the explanation, and my suggestion is always have an awareness of where your exit is. You don't ever want to have your horse, whether you're riding the horse or on the ground, have that horse get you hemmed in against a fence or a rail or anything like that. Okay, so I try to give people that habit when we're in the clinic situation. People don't realize that when they put themselves physically between a horse and a fence, that unless you're a good, fast climber, you know, that horse could get scared at the littlest thing and mash you into the fence. And I've seen it done plenty of times. So always have the habit of being to the outside. Have your horse really understand that they need to respect your personal space. So when that horse gets scared, he's going to go anywhere but on top of you. I don't care if they're, you know, dragging out at the end of a 12-foot line. They're going to be far away, not on top of me. Okay, because a 1,200-pound horse can mash a human in a heartbeat. I hate when that happens. And the third thing is when you're not in the distracted scenario, demonstrate leadership. Ask more from your horse. Ask for a snappier departure. Ask for them to back up quicker. Ask for them to be, you know, you're so compelling. You're asking so much of them. You're challenging them that they kind of wake up and brighten up and look at you at a whole different level. You know, it's a little bit like the old Mary Tyler Moore show when, you know, Mary Tyler Moore finally stands up to her boss, Lou, and gets upset, and then her friend Rhoda says, "Mary, I've never seen you like this. I like it." The horses are attracted to that, and it'll keep you safe. And then when things unravel or conditions change, then you automatically go into leadership mode rather than the back off and soothe them and hope they calm down mode. It doesn't work. Actually has a reverse effect. So that's why this horse coming from a dude train or a dude ranch with horses around and emotion, all that stuff, that horse had a job. And so when wranglers were bringing that horse in or taking that horse or riding out, no matter what was going around, that horse had a job to do. Nobody stopped and soothed it and said, you know, something's going to happen. But those are people that work professionally with horses. They don't have kind of those habits that a lot of people do that don't have horses in their lives, you know, for their whole lives or necessarily have a job with them. So hopefully that will give you some insights and some perspective, and it'll change your expectation of what you're asking of your horse when you're doing the ground skills. I mean, that's the reason you do the darn ground skills, is so that when those things happen, it becomes automatic. But don't wait until things unravel on you to ask more from your horse. Your horse needs it in everything. When we, horses and children will raise to our expectations, they'll also lower to our expectations. And where it gets revealed is when things unravel on us. Then we realize, you know, how little leadership we really have. The horse may understand what we're asking, and they may be compliant and going, okay, I'll do this, but don't ask, you know, too much of me. Okay. Lead horses ask a lot of the other horses from the instant they come nose to nose, don't they? So to me, it's changing our expectations, understanding what leadership means, and then developing your skills and habits to demonstrate leadership, not if, but when those things happen. And ultimately, what you do is you go, what running horse? I don't see a running horse. What horse is riding in the arena? To me, it's I'm the only one in there. If my horse starts looking around at other things, what that means is I'm not being interesting enough or challenging enough or provocative enough for to be able to hold a conversation amidst whatever else is going on around me. So hopefully that gives you some insights of how to go about that.
Okay. And Paige, feel free to email us back and let us know how that goes. It's really fun to get those emails back after Karen's had her teleseminar and get to hear the positive feedback and response that they get from your answers. So,
yeah, I love to get the feedback because, you know, I'm throwing information out there. And, you know, at a clinic, I can see people get it and do it, and they go, ah, I get it. But it goes out into teleseminar land, and I go, well, I hope it helps somebody.
Yeah.
So I do. I really love it when I get feedback, you know, and get the comments back. It's like, oh, yes, you know, really helps somebody.
They got
out.
It, yeah. Yeah. This next one, Karen, is from Melissa. and she's still in her childhood dream. And I'd like to compliment her because she's doing the right things and asking a lot of questions. And in this email, there is several questions, but I feel you can probably kind of cover them all here. It says she's taken a step of faith, and she's in the process of buying a mild-mannered horse that I am convinced will help me fulfill a childhood dream. Yes, I have your email of encouragement from a couple of months ago, and I'm going to do this. I am mentally preparing by doing a lot of reading and learning from Karen's DVDs like Cornerstone of Communication, Riding from the Ground, and others that I haven't watched yet. For the horse, I've arranged secure boarding near my home, and I'm getting a few of the basics and equipment until I get my horse home and can have him fitted for a saddle, etc. My question is how to do the best for him once he arrives. He'll be sharing a very large corral with two other friendly horses. Should I put him in right away with his new buddies, or would it be better to put him in by himself for a day or two? So that's kind of question number one. Should I let him rest in the corral, or would it be better to put him in a round pen and let him...
Nope. I lost you there, Melinda. Okay. I've lost Melinda. She might have hit a button and hung up. So I'll go ahead and answer the first question. I'm sure she'll dial back in here once she realizes she's talking to nobody. There may be five more questions. You might keep talking. Not that we all haven't done that. when you don't realize somebody that you've hung up. The thing I like to do with horses when introducing new horses, it depends on your setup. If you have a setup that has a good solid fence that has no edges on it that can cut or wire or anything like that, it's not a bad idea to let the horse go in and just relax, you know, on the new property in the stall area in a place where the other horses can come in and sniff, they can get acquainted, they can, you know, kind of visit a little bit. The reason I say fencing is because when you do that, you know, even though, and everybody's seen this, even though there's fencing between horses. Hey, Melinda, we were wondering how long it would take for you to realize you'd hung up.
I could hear you, but you could not hear me.
Oh,
so,
no, I couldn't hear you at all.
Okay.
I don't know. Mark could hear me, so he said to go ahead and answer that first question. So I started to answer the first question.
Good deal. Okay. So,
let me finish with that, introducing horses to each other.
Okay.
So I talked about it depends on fencing, and the reason is that, you know, horses, even though there's fencing, horses will kick or strike and, you know, put feet through fencing. I almost lost one of my horses because there was a fairly assertive horse that we separated him from, and I was out of the country for 2 months, so I put him out in pasture, had total trust, the person my horse was with, everything was all good. But the fencing between these two horses, and it was fairly safe fencing. My horse was a lead horse, that horse was a lead horse, and they fought enough through the fence that my horse got hurt. And the poor person that was watching my horse had to take him to the vet. I wasn't able to be reached. I mean, it was a real mess. What she decided to do, which I really complimented her on after I got back, is she put the horses in together. Because at least they could demonstrate their leadership, you know, more safely than through a fence, because she wasn't set up to be able to remove, you know, to put a barrier between the two, put a buffer between the two. You know, so you want to be aware of the fencing because horses will demonstrate leadership, you know, through fencing. So after the horses kind of sniff each other, what I suggest is take the new horse and turn them out with one of the horses at a time, if you can. If you're not set up to do that, I've taken my horse and, you know, because of situations or conditions or whatever, you know, he knows the deal, and I'll put him out with a group of horses. You know, I've done that multiple times. And they sort it out, you know. So you can have horses on two sides of the fence for years, but until you put them out there together, they're going to really, you know, sort it out. It's almost like, you know, with a fence between them, they're both kind of equalized. And they actually kind of fight more. When you put them out together, it kind of gets done and over with. Now, I have to put a disclaimer in there because people say, oh, well, you know, a horse, it could break his leg, it could kill him, and that's true. A horse can kick another horse and break their leg, and you have to put them down. My horses are not shod. I don't have any iron on their feet. It does make a difference with impact, just like wearing brass knuckles. So I do know people that have horses out together. They prefer to have the horses shod, but they'll leave the back feet unshod. The back feet bear less weight than the front. You know, but my horses don't need shoes for what I do. So having barefoot horses, that's a benefit to barefoot horses, among other things. So, you know, but putting them out, you know, one at a time and letting them kind of sort things out and then put the three of them out together. The thing you want to make sure when you have horses out together is that the corners of your pen are no less than 90 degrees. Anything less than 90 degrees, a horse can get trapped in because there's no way for them to get out. And 90 degrees can get kind of dicey sometimes too. A lead horse can go in and kind of corner a horse. And they're just doing it, messing around, doing what horses do. So you want to have your corners at least 90 degrees or more open. Sometimes people will take a corner and put a panel. They'll secure a panel in the corner so there isn't a tight 90-degree corner that a horse can get trapped in. You know, make sure your gate to your pen. Sometimes people have a gate that opens into a paddock that goes into a stall. Make sure those are closed. When you turn horses out, I prefer that you close those gates because, again, two horses can go into a stall together and the lead horse can corner the other horse, you know, and have them taking some big hits when, you know, they should be able to get away and get out of there. That's what I would do is I would, you know, and take your time. It doesn't have to happen in a day or a week or anything. You can kind of see how they get along. But don't be surprised when you take the two friendly horses and introduce the new guy that maybe one of those friendly horses doesn't seem so friendly, okay? And it's usually not the lead horse. Usually it's the lesser horse. Because they kind of puff up and go, well, I'm below that horse, but I'm sure as heck not going to be below you. So oftentimes the horse that's at the lowest in the pecking order is oftentimes the one that comes up, you know, kind of big and puffed up and, you know, almost like a bully until, you know, the new horse comes in, you know, and they sort out. They sort out where, you know, where they are in that pecking order. So that's how I go about it. If you're set up to be able to do that, it's a great way to do that. And again, make sure the area is big enough so that all three horses have enough room to get away. Sometimes I see people put in, you know, keep horses in a smaller area, and so the horse is trying to get away from the lead horse that can't. So you have to kind of gauge that. And every once in a while, I can count on one hand how many times this has happened. I've seen two horses just absolutely not get along, almost like, you know, people, where we meet that one person that just, I don't know, it's something where we just don't click, and it never changes. So it's kind of an interesting dynamic to see with horses. But to me, those are the things to really consider when you're introducing new horses into a herd.
Okay. To continue on with her question, she said he's also coming from a high elevation that is dry. He's coming from a very low elevation that is relatively humid at mild, high elevation, and going into a dry, high elevation. Is there anything that she should anticipate with these environmental changes as far as exercise while he adjusts to the change in elevation with climate?
Yeah, you know, horses really adapt fairly quickly. The ranch I was working out of for years there was at about 7,800 feet. In Colorado, and horses came from, you know, Phoenix up there, and that's where I moved my horses up from. You know, their physiology, their cardiovascular system will adapt relatively quickly. Just use your common sense, just like you would with your own time to adapt to, you know, different climates. The thing that you may want to adjust for is weather. Because if you're going into a high climate, even though it's dry, it may be quite cold. Anything more than 20 degrees difference, you may want to consider putting a light blanket on until spring, and then the horse can cycle through the fall and into the winter and adapt into the winter. We moved from Phoenix up to Colorado in April, and the horses came off the trailer, and they were shivering. I mean, and it wasn't because it was breezy in the trailer or anything. It was just April in the mountains of Colorado. So, you know, I have to adapt. And that's probably for another teleseminar is blanketing, you know, talking about blanketing, what my preferences are. But, you know, I don't use blankets typically unless I'm having to make that kind of a jump, kind of more than, you know, 15, 20 degrees you'll see in the horse. And I'll use blankets to make that adjustment for the horse. Last spring, my horses had shed out for where I was at in the spring in Phoenix. They had shed out by late March, early April. I went into Colorado, and I didn't realize horses would do this. It doesn't surprise me now, but they grew a second winter coat. Now, I kept them blanketed even, and I had them blanketed. I didn't have them under lights or anything like that, but they grew a second winter coat, and that winter coat took forever to shed out. I kind of joked like they were going, well, we're not sure where you're going to take us, you know, but it was really interesting to me that they could shed out, almost completely sleeked out, and then rebuild their winter coat when we got up into higher elevation again. So, you know, using heavier blankets and just making that adaptation for the horse until they make that adjustment.
Okay. So, Karen, we're going to probably go ahead and time-wise and move on to another question. Diane's kind of been waiting on this saddle fitting question. We talked about it in October, but we didn't get it recorded, and she wasn't able to listen in, and I know she's wanting to find a saddle for her horse. And so if we could go ahead and move on to this one. She says she has a really big horse with no withers, and she doesn't know what to look for in the way of a saddle. And so if you can help with some suggestions there for Diane in West Virginia.
Okay. The mutton withered horse is probably one of the most challenging horses to fit securely with a saddle. And people will say all kinds of things from, you know, flex trees and treeless, you know, and all kinds of things. There's actually an article coming out in Equine Wellness Magazine. I'm not sure which month it's coming out, that I just finished with the final edits and final revisions and everything that I wrote on saddle fitting. And that would be a really good article to read because it's pretty extensive. I mean, I don't remember how many words, 900 words. And, you know, we don't have enough minutes for 900 words to give you the big perspective. But something I can tell you that really helps with low-withered horse, or another term is mutton-withered horse, is to be sure to use a breast collar and a back cinch, or maybe even breeching. Okay, if you're not familiar with breeching, is if you picture a horse in a harness and there's a wide piece of leather that goes around the hips of the horse. And on a saddle, usually people will use it on mules or a pack animal where it's attached to the saddle. And what that does is when a horse is going downhill, it'll prevent that saddle from slipping forward up onto the horse's shoulders and even up onto the neck. Now, a saddle, not many people know this unless you ride in really steep country, a saddle that isn't fitted with that can actually get up onto the horse's neck. And I actually watched a saddle one time. It's a story for around a campfire sometime, but I watched a horse peel a saddle off itself, and it had a back cinch and a breast collar, and it peeled it off itself up over its neck. Its front feet stepped back through both cinches. It was a wreck, you can imagine. And the horse was tied to a hitching rail. And when that horse got done, that saddle was peeled off over its neck, over its head. It was hanging on the lead rope between the halter and the hitching rail. Okay.
Wow.
So, and actually, I'll tell you, if you're trying to imagine how he did that, the horse was tied too long, got turned around, backed up, panicked, got under, felt the hitching rail on its behind, sunk down under the hitching rail, got the hitching rail between the saddle and its back, and it got stuck. And I watched this with my own eyes. And instead of going forward, that horse went backwards and peeled that saddle off. Now, a saddle can do that if you're riding in steep country as well. So it may not come all the way off. You know, if you're on it, usually you'll stop at a level spot or turn sideways on a steep hill and reset the saddle. But, boy, you get on and start going downhill again, and it starts shifting. I've seen saddles, you know, the mane starts disappearing underneath the front of the saddle and some of the country I've ridden in. So breaching is something I don't think many people really consider doing. And like I said, unless they're packing a horse or using mules, because mules don't have much of a wither. Some mules do have more withers than others. But typically they don't, so you'll see breaching. Another thing you can use to help stabilize the saddle from shifting too far forward is a crupper. And that's where you see a lot of, it's kind of standard equipment on an Australian stock saddle. In Australia, the stock horses, the people that, you know, go out and move stock and, you know, go on droves and everything, you see it in movies, Australia and different things, you know, it's a leather strap that comes down to a piece that goes underneath the horse's tail. And there's a way to fit it so that it's comfortable for the horse. But the horse can actually take quite a bit of weight right underneath their tail. And light harness, when you go into harness horses, light harnesses won't use the breeching. They'll use crupper style in light harness. And what that does is you attach it to the shafts, and when you want it to slow, you know, the horse is the brakes, you know, for the carriage. So, you know, it's either going against their hip with the breeching or it's going under the tail with the light harness. So, you know, those are some things to think about that can help stabilize the saddle on the back of a horse that really doesn't have very prominent withers. The problem, and what the breast collar does, is everybody thinks, oh, the breast collar is just for, you know, to keep the saddle from shifting back, and it is for that. But it's also for, if a saddle should shift side to side, it gives it a little bit of stability so that saddle won't slip all the way off. It'll get hung up kind of at the shoulder underneath the arm, kind of in the armpit, it's not the armpit, the leg bit, on the opposite shoulder. So if you can imagine, make sure you get a breast collar that attaches down to the D-ring that's in most cinches in the middle. So that piece, if you can imagine a saddle slipping accidentally, that piece would get hung up there and it'd prevent that saddle from slipping, you know, clear under the horse's belly. So it gives you more chance to get off and get out of there safely. And other than that, you know, I know people have come out with all kinds of pads and rubber grippy pads and all those kinds of things. You know, and some people will swear by them and say that really helps. To me, anything rubbery against the horse's back, even if it's waffle, you know, so it has little pinholes in it so the air can flow through, rubber on hair, just it's too grippy and it pulls. So anything that's rubbery, neoprene, anything like that, I'm not a real fan of. I've used it because I've tried it. Like I said in the beginning of the teleseminar, I try everything. But, you know, even on your own hair, if you've ever had a hairdresser wash your hair when you go to get a cut and they put rubber gloves on and they're washing your hair. I had one hairdresser was allergic to any chemicals, so they wore rubber gloves. And I'm telling you, usually you're in there going, oh, I love the hair washing part, and I was in pain. So they were using rubber gloves, and that rubber had enough pull on my hair. My hair was being pulled for 10 minutes while they washed it. So it's not my favorite. Now, if it's going to save your life and you find something that works, like a thin piece of grippy something, you know, if it's at the discomfort of the horse but it's at your safety, that may be the option for you to go. But it's a tough one. It's a real tough one for people to deal with. And believe me, I had a custom-made saddle for the horse. I know I've told this story before in my other teleseminars. I own a horse that has almost no withers, and I had a custom-made saddle. And this saddle is beautiful. I waited, you know, 18 months to get it. I paid big bucks, thousands of dollars for this saddle. And it came in, fit my horse. I rode my horse with it. It was great. Everything was wonderful. Well, I don't ride that horse anymore. She's retired. She's in her late 20s. So now I have this wonderful saddle that's fitting. You know, it's beautiful. But, hey, you can buy that saddle. maybe that will fit your horse. I don't know. But you know, so having a custom-built saddle isn't always the answer either. But I'd go ahead and find that article, go on Equine Wellness Magazine, you know, look them up. They have a website, I'm sure. Watch for that article coming out. That'll give you some more perspective. There is a saddle maker that I really, really like working with, and he's on my Facebook. I don't know if he's on my website quite yet, but it's Misty Mountain Saddlery. And he makes a really great saddle. Melinda wrote it, you know, when we did camp there in Missouri last year. And Melinda, I mean, it's my favorite saddle. I'm sad because I don't have that saddle. I sent that saddle back, and I'm going to get my saddle on order here pretty quick. But I'm really missing it. And Melinda knows because people started fighting over it at the 5-day camp. Melinda, nobody wanted to give it up. Once you sat in that saddle, you just did not want to give it up. So you can contact Misty Mountain Saddlery and talk with a saddle maker. And his name is Jan. It's spelled J-A-N, Janiman. And he's from South Africa, and he's made saddles with his brother for years and years and years. And he just has impeccable quality to his saddles near some specific features. But that was my big question when I talked with him. I said, you know, Jan, what do you recommend, you know, for people with horses that have very little wither? And we had the same discussion. So, those are some things to think about. But it's a tough one. It's a real tough one.
Okay, Karen.
Mark just looked it up. Sorry, Melinda, Mark just looked it up on the website. And that article is coming out in Equine Wellness Magazine in the March-April issue, later this month.
Okay, great. That's something for us to look forward to. So are you going to put that on the website, too, so if we don't remember where it is, we can kind of refer back to that? Okay.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't own the article. Articles that I own I put on the website, but you may have to go through Equine Wellness. Get that. But I'll tell you what, Equine Wellness, have you seen that magazine, Melinda?
I haven't.
Equine Wellness. It's a terrific magazine. It's a very open-minded magazine about lots of different subjects and topics. You know, just like anything you read in any horse magazine, you can agree with it or not. But it's very progressive. It's very open-minded and, you know, everything from traditional to holistic, you know, and everything in between. So they asked me to write an article on it, you can hear in my teleseminars. You can imagine when I write an article and they say, would you write an article on saddle fitting, you know, saddles, you know, that general topic. Huh, you can imagine. Actually, I think they put it into a two-part thing. I sent them I don't know how many words it was, and I said, you figure out how to edit this, because you know, if I leave a part out, this is what I feel very sincerely, if I leave a piece out of it, then you don't have all the considerations that I do. And I feel that that's irresponsible on my part. I know it takes more time to answer those questions, but, you know, to me, even if you've already heard, you know, 60% of it, that 40% might be the piece that's going to make the difference for you. So that's why I try to explain things, you know, simply but completely.
Well, Karen, I think you do a great job of that, because I know sometimes when you're answering a question, if you just kind of set your eyes and start picturing what you're saying, you're really good at giving a very clear, just like when you're talking about the horse at the hitching rail and pulling back and the horse, you know, the saddle coming up over there. I mean, you can picture what you're saying. So you do a really good job at getting that information clearly to us. So.
Good. I'm glad.
Well, Karen, can you believe an hour has gone by already? I didn't get all my questions in.
I know. Well, I want to make sure, because, you know, it was cute at the very beginning when you asked the question, you know, am I too big for my horse? And I was kind of laughing to myself. I said, well, maybe we'll run out of time. That's a tough question.
I know.
But I want to touch on that just very briefly. It's very rare that I see somebody that's really, truly too big for the physical strength of the horse. Some people will say so. It's almost more aesthetic than anything. Like you see full-grown people in countries, they'll ride, you know, these little, little, you know, fell ponies and you know, burros and the Icelandics and things. You know, they're big, grown people. So strength-wise, I don't always find that that's the case from the horse's perspective. It's kind of more aesthetic, comfort. You know, if it's a young horse, I have seen, you know, great big, you know, people that are starting a colt on a colt that probably needs another, you know, year on it before it even gets started. I have seen that. But those horses, I mean, they'll go off like little troopers. You know, so that's kind of a quick answer, but we can talk about that more the next time. But I did want to talk about that a little bit.
Okay, so we'll pick that one up for next month. That'll be our first question as we get started next month. So, okay. Karen,
if I want
really
that person sitting there going, well, I thought you'd tell me today, and now I got to ride my horse for another month worrying that I'm too big. You're probably not. Probably not.
Well,
it's really rare that I see that. So.
Okay, all right, because she is wanting to start riding again and was wondering, you know, if she's got a 22-year-old Polish Arabian, and
mm-hmm.
she's just, it's 14.3, and she weighs 237, and was concerned there. But the horse is flea-bitten gray and has melanoma, and evidently
mm-hmm.
It's better for him if he keeps moving and stuff. It helps prevent it from spreading, so she wants to get, you know, get him riding again. So
I would say on a little Arabian, actually that was the smallest horse of mine personally that I ever owned was a little Arabian. And I'll tell you what, I looked aesthetically, I was too big for him. But I'll tell you what, he was a big mover. He didn't miss a beat. Little Arabians are so sturdy. They're so handy. I would say probably not. I would say not. If you're an athletic, you know, 200 plus. So, you know, it may be an aspect, you know, and we all face this, you know, especially as we age. It's really important to maintain our fitness level because it's not so much the weight. You could have a man weigh that much that, you know, works out all the time, you know, and I wouldn't say too much. But if we're not keeping ourselves in the shape and condition, we can get to where, you know, we're not as balanced on the horse's back. And that's where it's more risk. I wouldn't say it's too big for the horse physically, but we want to make sure that we, you know, keep some semblance. And believe me, I have to work at it, you know, myself. It's not, I'm not some natural little thin little waif of a person, believe me. But it's something that's really important and we need to keep that in mind as well. So.
Well, we got that in real quickly. So, listen, we appreciate everybody joining us tonight. Everybody keep safe, and please tune in. Get your questions to us next month, and we'll check in with you next month. Thanks, Karen.
Thank you, Melinda. Have a good evening, everybody.
Okay, good night. Bye-bye.
Bye.